Okay, let's get started. So, first of all, nice to be back here at Dhammaroka Center. I haven't seen any of you for, many months. It's good to be back here again. There's a nice spiritual community here. One of the great things to come here on Friday nights and to see everyone. So, good to be here again. And when we kind of start the year, so to speak, after the rains retreat, one of the things that I like to do is come back to some of the basic teachings of the Buddha. Basic things that kind of give you the foundation where all of these things come from, what they're all about, how it all hangs together, if you like. And one of the things that I always enjoy talking about Buddhism from many different angles. I always enjoy talking about practical applications of Buddhism, how Buddhism works in a modern society, the modern problems that we have, and how that actually integrates with the Buddhist teachings. It's a very useful way of looking at things, because you then understand the basic principles and how they apply more broadly in any culture, in any kind of historical period. So that is all very interesting. I think it's a very important part of a spiritual teacher to deal with those things. Yeah, it really matters that it actually is relevant to our lives. It deals with contemporary phenomena. It doesn't just kind of deal with things that sounds like they came from 2,500 years ago, has no relevance to present life. So that's important. But also, even more important than that, I think, are the basic teachings of Buddhism, the things that actually make it clear what this is all about, how it all hangs together, because these are the things that actually sustain your practice in the long run. If you understand how what Buddhism really is pointing to, what it comes down to, and then you come back to that, reflect on it again and again and again. As you do that, gradually it sinks in. Gradually you get clarity about these things. Gradually it becomes something that actually sustains your practice and gives rise to the commitment and perseverance that is so important on this path. If you're going to really work, if this path is going to work for you, you have to commit and persevere for a very long period of time. This is the hardest part of Buddhism, yeah? And this is why it's so useful to come back to the basic things. One of the strange things that some of you may have noticed about the Buddhist teachings is that, I don't know if many of you read the suttas. It was embarrassing when I asked how many read the suttas. Not that many people put up their hands. But for some of you who might read the Buddhist teachings, the suttas or the discourses of the Buddha, sometimes people say, oh, it's so boring. This Buddha is just repeating himself all the time. Why can't he make it a bit more interesting, like Ajahn Brahm? You know, a few jokes, a few stories, that kind of stuff. Actually, there are a few stories in there. I'll get to some of the stories afterwards. But it's not like Ajahn Brahm. Yeah? Let's face it, the Buddha is a more kind of... how shall we put it? It has not as many jokes in the suttas as there are in the, in Ajahn Brahm's talks. That doesn't mean the Buddha was humorless. In fact, there have been theses and papers written about the humor of the Buddha. Because sometimes the Buddha seems to have a kind of a sense of humor, a bit kind of more low key than kind of kind of jokes and that kind of stuff. But still, a degree of humor there. So it's actually there. But still, when you come to these suttas, they can seem repetitive. They can seem dry. They can seem kind of not all that interesting in many ways. But once you get used to this, once you get used to reading these things, and you read maybe the same ideas again and again and again, what you start to notice is that even though it is the same basic ideas, they're often expressed from slightly different points of view. With slightly different content, giving slightly different context to how these things are given. And once you start to notice that, you actually start to get a feeling for the richness of these teachings. They're actually very rich. The same thing given again and again and again, but with slight variations on the theme. And as you do that, you start to get a really good encompassing knowledge, understanding of what this is about. And this is the beauty of these discourses, and this is why I think it is useful to come back to the basic teachings again and again. So for this reason, tonight I'm going to talk about the Four Noble Truths. Actually, it would be interesting to see how many people here have never heard about the Four Noble Truths. Is there anyone who's never heard about the Four Noble Truths? You cannot raise your hand, John, because that would be cheating. Anyone has never heard of the Four Noble Truths? Everyone has heard about the Four Noble Truths. One over there. Okay, one person. Okay, good. So Great. So only one person. That's pretty amazing. You're really well educated lot, aren't you? I mean, everyone knows about the Four Noble Truths. So that's pretty good. In a sense, maybe not that surprising, because it is obviously a very basic and fundamental teaching of the Buddha. So now you're going to become part of the crowd. You're the last person going to be inducted into the Buddhist teachings after today. So you also feel more like you're part of the in-group of the Buddhist people here. So Four Noble Truths. And why are these Four Noble Truths so important? And they really are a fundamental teaching of the Buddha. Why is that the case? And there's a number of reasons for that, but one of the reasons that the Buddha gives himself, he says that the Four Noble Truths, this is actually the thing that we need to understand as Buddhists. This is the thing that actually gives rise to the awakening enlightenment experience. What you actually see when you get enlightened, you're all heading for enlightenment, right? So we're all heading towards this. So what you actually see is precisely this. You see the Four Noble Truths. This is actually what the awakening experience consists of. And of course, because it consists of that, the sooner we can kind of start to get these things on board, start to understand what this is about, and move to kind of align our view with the view of the Buddha, the more closer we are to the actual awakening itself. It's a gradual process. As you start to see these things in a way that the Buddha saw it, you're actually moving in that direction already. So one of the most important reasons for talking about this is actually this idea of having the right outlook, the right way of looking at the world that is in accordance with how the Buddha actually saw the world. Only then is there a chance that you may actually move towards the same insight yourself. So very important for that reason. This is actually fundamental things. But at the same time as it is fundamental, at the same time as it is about the very basis insight into the nature of existence, it is also a very broad teaching that encompasses all other teachings in Buddhism. It's one of the suttas. Sutta means discourse of the Buddha. One of the discourses of the Buddha. The Buddha says, actually not the Buddha doesn't say this, the Venerable Sariputta says this, the Buddha's right-hand monk. Do we have him here? No, he's not here. Can't see properly. No, it doesn't seem to be here. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Venerable Sariputta, he says that all good teachings, and of course good teachings means the teaching of the Buddha more than anything else. It may also mean other teachings that align with that, but it certainly means the teachings of the Buddha. All these good teachings are encompassed in the Four Noble Truths. So it's also a very, very broad category. Everything else falls into this. So once you understand these things, it's like you have the frame of your jigsaw puzzle. If every discourse of the Buddha is like a piece in the jigsaw puzzle, the Four Noble Truths are like the frame that holds everything together, and the whole picture becomes possible because of that. So again, very useful to understand what these things are about. Four Noble Truths. And before I explain these things in more detail, which I will do in a minute or so, I just want to very briefly explain what they are, so that also the newbies, I'm glad there was one newbie, otherwise I can't say them in brief, so I will say them in brief first of all. In brief, the Four Noble Truths are, the first Noble Truth is known as Noble Truth of Suffering, or perhaps Unsatisfactoriness, is a different translation, but I think suffering is often quite to the point. And this means that any existence, especially human existence, of course, but any other existence as well, if you're an animal or whatever other kind of being you might be, is inherently problematic. There is no such thing as a life without suffering. And I'm sure most of you will know that that's true. There's always things that go wrong. Sometimes minor things, that's called minor suffering, but sometimes big things. People in our family pass away, they die. How many people find that not traumatic? Very few people find that not to be traumatic at all. When someone very close to you, who is very means a lot in your life, when they die, it's very difficult for most people. And these are experiences that are inherent to human existence. We can't live without having people close to us pass away every now and again. Not too frequently, hopefully, but every now and again it's going to happen. Suffering is inherent to human existence. Nothing has gone wrong if you suffer. people think things have gone wrong when you suffer. But actually, that is the wrong way of looking at it. Once you think that something has gone wrong, what you start to do is to try to search for solutions to this. Sometimes there are solutions, but there is no solution to the overall problem, that there are problems in life, that there is suffering in life. So instead of always looking for solutions, it's far better to contemplate this, understand this. What does it actually mean if life is inherently suffering? And what it means, of course, is that we have to start to look at life in a different way, and start to orient how we think about things, how we do things in a manner which is different from what we normally do. This is really the fundamental reason why outlook here matters so much, because we change how we live. Not necessarily what we do, but certainly how we live. First noble truth. Second noble truth is about the cause of suffering. What is the cause of suffering? Craving, desire, all of these things. Wanting, this is the cause of suffering. And that's good news. It is good news that there is a cause to suffering. Because if there is a cause, it means that if we eliminate the cause, we can deal with the result. The result will fall away. If suffering didn't have a cause, we'd be in serious trouble. It would be like this kind of solid thing that is always there. Can't do anything about it. But because it has a cause, it's actually a good thing. The second noble truth kind of already gives rise to a sense of hope. The third noble truth says that with the elimination of the cause, suffering ends. There is such a thing as the end of suffering. And this is one of those amazing things about the Buddha's teaching. And the thing, I think, which makes this path so worthwhile, and makes it so close, if you like, to the very thing that we all yearn for, that we're all searching for in life, what life really is all about, is of course an end to problems, a movement towards a higher kind of happiness and satisfaction in life. So there is that possibility, according to the Buddha. So that's the third noble truth, a very kind of positive way of looking at life. And the last one is the path that leads to that goal, the Noble Eightfold Path. So that's the four noble truths in brief. Now, one of the things that is also interesting to contemplate while we're looking at the four noble truths is, why did the Buddha formulate his teachings in this particular way? Why four noble truths? Why not five? Why not three noble truths? Why not one noble truth? Why not 1,000 noble truths? Surely we could have structured this in many different ways. Why is it structured in this precise way? And to understand this, what we have to do is we have to go back to the time of the Buddha. We have to look at how the Buddha, his experience, and how it fitted in with the culture at the time. And so what happened to the Buddha is, of course, that he went forth, he became a monk or a monastic. And then he had this experience. And this experience that he had, we call the awakening or enlightenment experience of the Buddha. Now that enlightenment experience is not an articulated experience. It's not something which kind of comes with words and everything like that. An insight, by its very definition, is something that you see in the moment. It's a flash. It's something that you see in a very peaceful and still mind. And there's no verbalization, there's no articulation part of that insight. And I'm sure you know what I mean. If you think about what insight is in ordinary life, you have a problem or something, you don't know how to actually deal with that problem, it's really hard, you think about it this way and that way, and afterwards you screw up your head and you kind of get a headache because you think about it too much. And then you sit back, you let go of everything, and bang, suddenly it comes to you. It's a flash of insight. And you realize that insight is actually very different from thinking. Sometimes you actually have to stop thinking to be able to have an insight. And this is one of the reasons why we do meditation practice. You can stop thinking for a while, and then you can have some insight as a consequence. This is what this is about. And it's exactly the same thing for the Buddha. The Buddha is no different from us. So when he was searching for these things, he sat down under the Bodhi tree, like the tree we have, the tree over there, Bodhi tree, and he, with the nice shaped leaves like this, he sat under this tree, according to the legend or mythology, and then he actually discovered, had this insight into the nature of existence. And then, after coming out, he had to struggle. And according to the suttas, it took him a long time to actually be able to articulate what he had discovered. He was sitting under the Bodhi tree for several weeks, just reflecting on his awakening experience. Yeah, and I think we can take it as fairly certain that what he was doing was trying to come to grips with this. What does this mean? I've just discovered the meaning of life, for goodness sake. How can I articulate this for other people? You get pretty excited if you discover the meaning of life. Yeah, you can imagine. Meaning of life, jeepers. Other people might be interested in this, yeah, if it's the meaning of life. They better be, otherwise they'd be really stupid if not interested in the meaning of life. So, and then he articulates this. And for the Buddha to be able to articulate it in a way that actually is comprehensible to the people and the society around him, he has to use the concepts and idea that existed at that time. And the particular concept that he used to formulate the Four Noble Truths is the concept that was used in medical science at that time. Yeah, and this has been pointed out by several scholars. I think it is fairly clear that that actually is the case. And of course, medical science at that time seemed to be built up of four elements. And these four elements, and it's very similar to how medical science works also in the present day, they're kind of fairly obvious, I suppose. First of all, you have the symptoms. Yeah, if someone has symptoms, and then when you have symptoms, you go to the doctor, and the doctor does a diagnosis, and the diagnosis decides what kind of illness is it. Yeah, is it a virus, a bacteria, is it cancer, what is going on here? And once you have the diagnosis, once you know what's going on, then you will know whether there is a cure or not. The third noble truth, yeah, is there a cure to this? And then lastly, if there is a cure, well, you give them the medicine that leads to that cure. And the Four Noble Truths are built up on exactly the same principle. You have the idea of the illness. The illness is suffering. Yeah, there is a problem that we want to get rid of, and this is like an illness in our life. It's something that we rather not have. First Noble Truth. Second Noble Truth is about the diagnosis. Well, what is actually going on here? The diagnosis is the problem is craving, desire, wanting. This is what actually keeps this going. By eliminating the craving, that you actually get the cure. And the path to that cure, the medicine that we have to take, is the Noble Eightfold Path. Yeah, so it is a medical kind of thing. And this is kind of nice, it's kind of neat, because in a sense it makes us think about our existence and about our life in a different way. We are all ill in a sense. Yeah, we all have this problem. We are here, there is a state of health that we can actually achieve. But right now we have a degree of illness about us. And many reasons why that is interesting, one of them is straight away it leads to compassion. Yeah, if you remember that all the people around you, we're all kind of stuck in this mire as if we are sick and ill in a certain way. Of course, then compassion for other people arises. So remember that. Everyone in this room here probably, unless you are an arahant, there's not usually that many arahants in rooms like this. I'm not going to ask you because it might be embarrassing if you happen to be an arahant, but I will leave it at that. But usually everyone has plenty of suffering in their life. And once you get that as an idea, as a reality, you can start to have so much more compassion for the people around you. It kind of comes out naturally. And so this is one aspect of the idea of illness. Another aspect of the idea of illness is that when you are ill, you often feel a bit confused. Your mind isn't really clear. Yeah, you don't really know what's going on. You don't have clarity about you. I just had a short illness about a week and a half ago. I haven't been ill for decades, I think, and suddenly I had like 2 days when I felt really out of it. And you feel kind of, you know, you can't really see up from down. It doesn't feel very nice when you have these illnesses. So you are confused. And this is exactly what happens to ordinary people as well. We're struggling to find our way in life. We're trying to kind of fumble around in the darkness, trying to find a way out of our problems. But often we have a sense of confusion, delusion, lack of clarity about things, not really understanding where the escape is from these problems that we have. Yes, you can have double compassion. Not only are people kind of sick, yeah, we're all kind of sick, but on top of that we are deluded. We don't know where to find happiness. We're fumbling around, yeah. And remember that whenever somebody does something stupid, whenever someone does something that you think you should be angry about, don't be angry. Have a sense of compassion for them. They don't know what they're doing. They are fumbling around. They want to be happy just like every one of us. And instead of making themselves happy by doing bad things, they make life worse for themselves. If that is the case, they are worthy of compassion. Yeah? Simple little teaching, but so powerful when you get them right. Remember that. This is what illness is like. So you are really out of it. And the last thing about illness, of course, I just said it already, you suffer a lot. One of the problems, we often don't know how much we suffer. I was reminded of that when I just had my illness about a week and a half ago. I was out, I didn't eat for about 3 days because I had no appetite. Yeah, you have fever, you're really kind of out of it. And I've just forgotten how miserable it is to be sick. It was a good reminder for me to kind of get back onto the, you know, to the Buddha's teaching about illness being suffering. And so how is it? How is it possible to understand this in the right way? We don't really feel that sick in ordinary life. Well, the way you understand this is that as you practice this path, as you come here and do your meditation practice, and you learn how to meditate properly, you start to emerge from this pile of dung. That's Ajahn Brahm's expression, the pile of the worm and his lovely pile of dung. You start to emerge. Instead of actually burrowing down into the dung all the time, you actually take the little hook and you kind of pull you out a little bit of dung. And as you do that, you start to get an overview of what is going on. And you start to see that actually what you previously took to be happiness, what you previously took to be perfectly okay, actually it is much worse than you thought. So you gradually emerge from the problems of life, you start to get perspective on what is happening, and then you start to understand what suffering really is all about. Only then do you understand this as you emerge from this. So there's a beautiful simile, and it's often nice to reflect on these things, because often there's a lot of meaning in these things. The idea of diagnosing an ill patient, and is similar to the way the Four Noble Truths are presented by the Buddha. But what I would like to do now is just to look a little bit more in detail on each one of these Four Noble Truths. So again, the first one is the noble truth of suffering. And the way the Buddha explains this noble truth is as follows. Are you ready? You may not already. The Buddha says, birth is suffering. Illness is suffering. Old age is suffering. Death is suffering. Being united with what you don't like is suffering. Being disunited or separated from what you like is suffering. Not getting what you want is suffering. In brief, the five factors of personality are suffering. This is the Buddha's definition of suffering, the first noble truth. And the first thing there is birth is suffering. Isn't that kind of strange? Birth is suffering? What does the Buddha mean by birth is suffering? It's kind of weird. Okay, you can kind of get that old age and death are suffering. It kind of makes sense. But birth, what is the problem with birth? And of course, once you start to reflect on it, it kind of perhaps makes a little bit of sense. You know, when you get born, it's probably a little bit traumatic. You're coming from your mother's womb, nice and warm and nice and cozy, and into the cold world, the brutal world outside. That must be quite traumatic, and of course we don't have any memory of these things, maybe fortunately, it's probably quite traumatic. And so probably the process of being born is probably not all that nice. But there is a deeper, and there's many reasons like that you can actually pull out why birth is suffering. But there is another way of understanding this. And this is to understand that when the Buddha talks about birth in the First Noble Truth, it doesn't actually refer to the birth in this particular life that we already had. What it refers to is future births. In other words, it is a reference to rebirth. How do we know that? And the reason we know that is because the purpose of the Buddhist path is to eliminate suffering, and you eliminate that through craving. The only birth that you can eliminate, because birth is suffering, is future birth. You cannot eliminate the birth you already had. At least I don't know any method for doing that, but maybe there is a way, but I haven't figured it out. Presumably you cannot eliminate the birth you already had, so it must refer to future birth. So birth is suffering, refers to rebirth. It refers to the process of getting reborn in what in Buddhism is known as the samsaric existence, of moving on from life to life, death to death, around and around, ever moving on. That is what it actually refers to. And this already is very interesting, because right there you start to understand that ideas such as rebirth, which sometimes are rejected in contemporary society, actually are completely integrated into the Buddhist teachings. The most fundamental of the Buddhist frameworks, the Four Noble Truths, it is right there. And not only is it there in the First Noble Truth, once you look at all four of them, actually it is there in every one of them. Yeah, and this is kind of the amazing thing. It's there in the Second Noble Truth, the third one, also the fourth one. And that shows you how integrated it is, how inherent it is to the Buddhist teachings. So by taking out rebirth from the Buddhist teachings, actually what you're doing is that you are collapsing one of the pillars that holds up the whole teaching here. You take that out, you have to reinterpret the teachings from scratch, and what you get is something completely different. An entirely different religion, if you can even call it religion, entirely different philosophy. And I will give you an example in a couple of minutes, exactly how that is and why that is the case. So that is birth and suffering, already quite interesting here. At least for me, I find it really interesting. I don't know about you, but I find it interesting, yeah. The second one, yeah, illness is suffering, old age is suffering, yeah. Yeah, it kind of makes sense, yeah, we kind of get that. But remember that these things also are inherent to human existence. Nothing has gone wrong when you have to go to the doctor, yeah. You know what Ajahn Brahm always says, yeah, when you go to the doctor, you should never say, "Doctor, doctor, something is wrong with me." You should say, "Doctor, doctor, something is right with me, I'm sick today." Yeah, and then the doctor sends you off to the nearest psychiatrist to make sure you're okay. Yeah. But it's true. It's actually so true. Nothing is wrong with you. This is inherent to human existence. You can expect illness. And hopefully you can also expect old age, because if you haven't got old age, well, actually that is much worse. So we can hopefully also have old age and illness. So this is part and parcel what it is about. This idea that these things are part and parcel of existence. This is an important thing, again, which drives home the point of what suffering is about. But the most important one, perhaps, in this particular context, the one I wanted to focus a little bit on, is the idea that death is suffering. Yeah, the fourth factor of these things that we have been looking at is actually death. Yeah, and I think it is fairly obvious why death is problematic, whether it's our own death or death of other people. It is fairly clear why that is, because this is where we have some of our strongest attachments, our stronger bonds to the people around us. But one of the things that is very interesting is how that the idea of death is also inherent in the Buddha's life story and what actually made the Buddha in the first place. This is actually one of those very interesting things that I think often is overlooked. In the traditional Buddhist ideas about how the Buddha ended up as a Buddha, how the Buddha to be practiced and became a Buddha, you have this idea of the Bodhisattva ideal. You have this idea of this man who has been practicing for many eons, and through those eons been purifying himself out of compassion for the world, trying to solve the riddle of existence, and then being able to teach others to overcome the suffering of life. Yeah? This is a standard kind of idea in Buddhism, the idea of the Bodhisattva ideal. But of course, what is interesting is that if you read how the Buddha himself talks about his own life, there's nothing there about compassion for other beings. That is not the motivating force that drives the Buddha to become the Buddha. So what is the motivating force for the Buddha? And his motivating force is the Buddha reflects on illness, old age, and death. And of those three, death is by far the most important one. Death is something the Buddha talks about again and again in the suttas. It is one of those fundamental contemplation of any spiritual life. Yeah, if you go to any kind of spiritual teaching that is worth its soul, so to speak, you will find that death contemplation always being an important aspect of these things. And Buddhism is no different. So this is the thing that made the Buddha go forth. Yeah, basically death contemplation. And that is quite interesting, because what that means is that this contemplation is so powerful that it drove the Buddha to realize awakening itself, and then after that teach the teaching that he had realized to the rest of humanity. And it's been going on for 2,500 years. And the whole thing is based on one thing. One person reflecting profoundly on the idea of death give rise to this whole thing we call the Buddhist teachings. Yeah, this is why we're here today, because the Buddha thought about death in a profound way 2,500 years ago. So what did he think? How come this simple idea that we all sort of know, but we don't really know, how come this idea could have such an impact on this person who was going to become the Buddha? And to understand that again, go back to the early discourses and see what the Buddha has to say about this. And one of the things that he says that there are two kind of searches in the world. One is called the noble search, one is called the ignoble search. Yeah, and he says the ignoble search is when I myself am subject to death. I know I'm going to die someday, and that is going to be difficult, of course. Then I go out and I seek for other things that are also subject to death. I seek for a wife, I seek for children, I seek for friends, I seek for all these material possessions. How come they are subject to death? Well, because you will lose them one day. They will have to go. I search for status in our society. I search for education. I search for success in my workplace. These two are subject to death, because when you die, all of that is going to have to be left behind. Or the body itself also is going to have to be given up when you die. So this contemplation of death is basically the realization that almost all the things that normal people look for in this world, all are bound to this world. They are subject to death. They're going to have to leave you at the very latest when you pass away. Yeah, and the Buddha realized that all I'm doing here, I'm searching for suffering. I'm putting so much effort into all of these things. And because I'm putting so much effort into these things, because they matter so much to me, because they are so meaningful to me, I'm going to attach to them. These are the things that I'm going to hold on to, precisely because they are so meaningful. And the more effort I put into it, the more I'm going to hold on to it, because the more meaningful it will be in my life. And I'm really just asking for suffering, because one day I'm going to have to let it all go. There's no choice. These things too are subject to death. They are subject to passing away. And when the Buddha realized that, what he did, he pulled back and said, why am I searching for all this stuff which doesn't have any meaning? I should search in a different way. Instead of doing the ignoble search, I should do the noble search and search for the liberation from these things. So the idea of death turns you around. It makes you look at the world in a different way. Instead of holding on to all of these things and asking for suffering down the line, instead you turn in a different direction and you ask yourself, is there a solution to this problem? Is there a way of overcoming this so I don't have to face this kind of suffering in the future? This is the power of this reflection. What this means, of course, is that if the Buddha used this, and the Buddha gained his awakening experience based on something as simple as the contemplation of death, and all of Buddha's and many other spiritual teaching also revolve around this concept, and they actually have come out of this particular idea, it means it is also very, very powerful in our own life. If you reflect on death repeatedly, not in a morbid kind of way, but in a way that enhances the quality of life, it is actually going to enhance your spiritual path dramatically. It is even said in the sutta that if you do as a monastic, if you reflect on death in the right way, there is no way that you can disrobe. Yeah, there's no way, because there's nothing out there really to hold on to in the world. The world is really just asking for more suffering. So you wouldn't disrobe simply by reflecting on death in the right way. So it is a very powerful thing. And I would recommend you, every one of you, to occasionally think about this, because it clears things up. It tells you what is important. You get the priorities right. What actually matters in life? Are you going to mess around and do stupid things if you could die maybe at any time? You're not. Yeah, every moment matters. Now is the opportunity. That's what death tells you. I can't really afford to have any enemies in my life. Can you afford to have any enemies? No, why? Because if you can die at any time and you have an enemy, that means you will die with that in your heart. So you can't, as a Buddhist, you can't really afford to have any enemies. Isn't that a wonderful thing not to be able to afford that? Because what it means is that every time you see the potential for making a bad relationship with somebody, you pull back because you understand, I can't afford this. This is going to be to my detriment. It's going to have a very bad consequence. That is one of the things that the contemplation of death does to you. So please reflect on that. Bring that into your spiritual repertoire, so to speak, and see if you can use that to actually enhance your spiritual practice. The next thing the Buddha talks about is being separated from what you like is suffering, being united with what you dislike is suffering, not getting what you want is suffering. Yeah, it's pretty obvious. And this happens all the time. Yeah, being separated, being united with what you don't like. Sometimes people say bad things to you, you're with someone you don't really want to be with, or someone dies or whatever. Yeah, this happens all the time. It happens on the very small scale, on the very micro scale, almost every day, every hour almost, and happens on the very large scale, the big things in life. And it's, again, a useful contemplation to remember that. And every time this happens, there is a degree of suffering there. It's an avoidable suffering here. And one of the things that I think you will see if you reflect on your mind carefully here is that very often we don't really, actually most of the time, we don't really live properly in the present moment. It is very hard to really be completely in the present moment. Very often we are like one or two steps ahead of ourselves. We're always moving towards something. And that movement is not just a physical movement. It is a movement of the mind. The mind is always kind of a step or two ahead. And this, you can see that in your meditation practice. The mind doesn't really want to be still right here and right now. It's going on about something else. And this is also, our lives are full of this, and we're active, we're moving towards something, and it's very hard to get a pure mindfulness. Only really in deep meditation are you able to get into a state of very powerful present moment awareness. Life in general it's not really suited for that, because it's always a pursuit of things, a movement towards something. Right there, you can see the problem of being separated from what you like. Because that is really what that is all about. This fact that we are always moving towards something, always desiring something, never really being 100% in the present moment. And there is a nice story, and I think I've told this story here before, but it's a nice story in the suttas. And this is a story of this monk called Samiddhi. Found the Samiddhi Sutta, and this monk Samiddhi, he is just having a bath, and he comes out of the bath, it's early in the morning or something, and he's drying himself and kind of puts on his robe. And then this devata, this god, this is like probably slightly mythological story, but it's a nice story regardless, because the meaning is very nice of this story. This deva comes down, and I don't know if this deva was female or male. It makes it perhaps a bit more kind of dramatic if it's a female, because then you have this kind of tension, the monk and then the female deva coming down. And then this female deva, or this deva, doesn't matter what gender it is, but this deva comes down and he says, she or he says to this monk, he says, you're young. Yeah, look at you. You're still, you have black hair, no gray hairs. You can still have fun. You can enjoy yourself, get a wife, and enjoy all the sensual pleasures in the world. Why have you gone forth as a monk? Yeah, it doesn't make any sense. What are you doing? And then she says, or he says, that all these pleasures in the world, they are right there for the taking. And instead of taking those sensual pleasures that are right there in the present moment, you are seeking for something far away, this distant thing called Nibbana, which who knows even if it actually exists. Why do you renounce those things that are available to you here and now to pursue a dream about the future? It kind of makes sense. Maybe she has a point. What do you think, Venerable Kassapa? Does she have a point? It's interesting, Maybe we have made a mistake. And then the monk Samiddhi, he says, wait a minute, that's not true. That's not how the Buddha teaches. The Buddha says instead that actually it is the spiritual practice, it is the Dhamma that is visible right here and now. It is sensual pleasures that are always in the future, that are always ahead of you, that you can't really ever grasp. And this is interesting, because on the one hand, it kind of makes sense what the Deva says. sort of makes sense. On the other hand, we kind of have some sympathy for this monk who kind of has the opposite kind of view. So who is right? And sometimes when you ask people who is right, people say, yeah, the Deva is right. But don't be fooled by this, because the whole point of this, it is like a spiritual conundrum. Why is it that the monk is right, even though it appears on the surface that actually the Deva is right? Every time you come here to meditate, you're trying to get into a nice state. How often does it happen? It's like this idea for the future sometimes. And the reason why it is right is precisely the thing I was saying before about being separated from what we want in life, or being united with what we don't want. We're always craving, we're always desiring, we're always moving towards something. We never actually reach the thing that we're moving towards. Or if we reach it partly, we straight away move on to something else. There's this continuous movement. There's always something in the future that we never actually reach. This is what life is about, and this is what sensual pleasures are about. This continuous movement from where we are to somewhere else. Always living in the future, never actually living in the present moment. So what about the Dhamma? What about the spiritual life? Why is that different? And the reason that is different is because if right now you sit down and you have an intention, you want to be kind to somebody else, you think a thought of kindness, you do an act of generosity right here in the present moment, how do you feel right here, right now? You feel good about yourself. Have you ever, I'm sure most of you know this by through experience, that when you do an act of kindness, afterwards you feel a kind of glow inside. You know you've done something right, and you feel happy about it. That experience of happiness is not about the future. It is an experience that you have right here in the present moment. It is the Dhamma, it is the spiritual life that happens in the present moment. The search for worldly things is always in the future, and it will always remain in the future. It cannot happen in the present moment. Craving by its nature is the gap between where you are and where you want to be. And this is what craving is all about. So there's a beautiful way of thinking about the difference between the spiritual life and the worldly life. They are diametrically opposed like that. Don't fall for what the Deva says. When the Deva says, go and enjoy yourself now. You have that. Can you hear that Deva in your ear sometimes saying that? This is the right thing to do. Just go and enjoy. Forget about that blooming spiritual life. Somewhere in the future, jhanas. Who knows about this blooming jhanas? I don't know. I'm talking about, I never had any jhanas before. Was I talking about these monks? Especially Ajahn Brahm. Don't fall for that. Spiritual things are simple little happiness that you can have right in the present moment, as long as you turn your mind in the right direction. You can have it now, not next moment, but now. The Buddha has another beautiful simile to explain this, and he talks about the simile of the dream. The simile of the dream is that the world, especially the sensual world, is like a dream. It's something that we think about in our mind, something that we're moving towards, an idea about the future that actually never comes true. Because as soon as it comes true, it wasn't really what you thought it would be, and for that reason you have to continue dreaming about something else. And so it goes on and on and on forever. The simile of a dream is one of the similes used by the Buddha to explain the problems of the worldly happiness, if you like. So this is, again, I think, a very interesting and important way of thinking about the First Noble Truth. And the last way that the Buddha talks about is when he talks about the five khandhas, these are the five aspects of personality, being, suffering. And the five aspects of personality being suffering basically means that the very constituents of who we are as human beings are problematic. If you look inside of yourself, you actually see that the way we are built up as human beings is problematic. So it's kind of inherent into the condition of existence that there is suffering. Now, to really understand that, you have to have insight. Because this is now getting very profound. When you start at the very inherent experience of existence is suffering, you can only see that through insight itself. And that insight happens gradually. It happens when you come here and you become a little bit peaceful. And when you become a little bit peaceful, you already realize that actually this is better than a lot of other things that I experience in life. The deeper you go in your meditation, the more profound that meditation is, the more understanding you have of this aspect of suffering. Because it is comparative, it's a relative kind of suffering. the depth of meditation, which is very, can be very peaceful and very sublime, puts everything else in relief. Suddenly now you see it in contrast, what you have now. And that contrast is what enables you to understand why the five personality factors are suffering. And ultimately you take it down to profound insight. And bang, that is when you understand what this is about. And this is another very important aspect of the idea of suffering, is that it ultimately is about insight into the nature of reality. And only through that insight can you fully grasp what the Buddha is talking about. Buddha's teachings are profound. Yeah, they're not kind of simple stuff. You can't just add up all your sufferings. No, it's much more than that. There's something inherent to the very idea of existence that is problematic. But I'll leave it at that with suffering, because probably by now you think that I'm obsessed about suffering. Interesting, people often say, oh, Buddhism is so negative, yeah, all this suffering. I don't suffer that much. I'm not interested in Buddhism. Yeah, forget about it. But that kind of misses the point completely, because the point is that if you understand the suffering, you also understand happiness. Yeah, if you have a full understanding of what suffering is about, you understand happiness as well. These things are come together. It's like night and day. Night only makes sense if you have day. Day only makes sense if you have night. These are pairs that always come together, complementary pairs. They only work together like that. So if you understand suffering, you also understand happiness. Yeah, that's the good news. So if you investigate suffering, you get to more happiness in your life at the same time. That's the good thing about this. So don't think it is negative. It is realistic and ultimately very positive. But what about the other noble truths? I want to talk about suffering so far. Let's get to the solution to the problem. The second noble truth is the problem, or the idea, that craving is the cause of suffering. Yeah. What does it mean that craving or desire is the cause of suffering? And I don't know, maybe you think it is obvious, but actually it is not as obvious as it may sound. Very often people say that craving is the cause of suffering. Why? Because when you crave, you suffer. I feel like I'm separated from where I want to be. I feel like this emptiness inside, this hole inside of me, something isn't complete. I feel dissatisfied, discontent. Craving really is the cause of suffering. But actually, when you think about it, that's actually not saying that craving is the cause of suffering. That's saying that craving is suffering. And this is exactly what we're talking about before, this idea of being united with what you don't like and separated from what you like. That itself is suffering. So craving itself is a state of suffering. That is not what is meant by the second noble truth. So what does it mean then? And what it means is that when you see the second noble truth, it is always explained as that craving that leads to rebirth. I was saying before that every of the four noble truths are about rebirth. That is also true of the second noble truth. It's actually explicitly stated there. It is rebirth craving which is the problem. It is through rebirth that suffering is perpetuated. If it only was a single life, it wouldn't be so problematic. But because it keeps on going on and on, potentially forever, that is why there is a real problem. That is the craving that actually is problematic. This is kind of interesting, and this is the craving that the Buddha is talking about. And again, shows you the importance of having this idea of the Buddhist kind of view and outlook about rebirth. Is fundamentally interwoven into the fabric of the Buddhist teachings and how it works. And this is why it is so problematic. I'll give you an example of what happens when you disregard this. This is kind of one of the horror stories, and I feel almost obliged to talk about this, so I can kind of straighten things out once and for all. Actually, there's no such thing as straightening things out once and for all, but at least I can straighten them out, maybe a tiny fraction, just right here and right now. But what happens is, if you then reject the idea of rebirth, is that you have to redefine the idea of craving. Craving must mean something else in the second noble truth, yeah? If it is not about rebirth, it must be about something else. So what people have proposed then, and this is actually has been proposed in all seriousness, it's not that craving leads to suffering, it's the other way around. Suffering actually leads to craving. Does that make sense? It's not what the Buddha said, but this is what this person has been claiming. Actually, this is really how this noble truth should be understood. Suffering leads to craving. And In a sense, it makes sense. You can make that argument, yeah, because if you suffer, what happens? You try to find a way out of that suffering, and that is a kind of craving, yeah, so you go searching perhaps for sensual pleasures, you go searching for happiness somewhere else. So suffering can lead to craving. There's nothing psychologically, from a psychological point of view, it kind of makes sense. But the problem is, it's got nothing to do with Buddhist teachings. It's got nothing to do with the Second Noble Truth. In fact, you have inverted the Second Noble Truth 180 degrees to make it function, to make it work with your idea that there is no such thing as rebirth. Yeah, you have inverted the teaching completely and come up with an entirely new idea. You have created a new religion. And that religion should be named after the person who invented it, not after the Buddha. He claims to be a Buddhist, but actually, you know, not really. And so we should kind of name it. I'm not going to say the names because it gets too kind of personal, perhaps. But so this is what happens, and it's scary because it shows you that if you start to deduct some of the fundamental things of the Buddhist teachings, to pull those out, what you have to do is you have to redefine the entire teaching to give it an entire new slant, a entire new way of looking at things, because the old way of doing things, the way the Buddha spoke, actually doesn't really work anymore. Everything has to be redefined, everything has to be changed, and you end up with something completely different as a consequence. So that is what this is about. Yeah, it is actually the craving that leads to rebirth. Why does craving lead to rebirth? Because craving is always a projection into the future. It's always about the future. It's about going somewhere else. It is by staying in the present moment, by not having this projection into the future, that actually the rebirth actually comes to an end. The mind no longer moves on in that direction. It stops right here and right now. And there's a nice little story that kind of, I think, illustrates this point quite nicely. And this is a story that I was reading during the Rains Retreat. I've been doing some little bit of translation work from the Pali into English. I really enjoy that because sometimes you get very close to the text when you do translation work. You have to really reflect on what these things mean. So I enjoy doing a bit of translation. And one of these things that I translate is a little story. This is a story of when the Buddha goes back to his family, his clan. Yeah, the Buddha was from the Sakyan clan. Sakyan clan was this tiny little republic in the north. East of India, just north of the river Ganges, actually quite a bit north of the river Ganges, almost in the foothills of the Himalaya mountains. And so he goes back after his awakening in a few years. He goes back to visit his family, and his family are really keen. Yeah, their son, their prodigious son, has become something enormous, something massive. He now has this whole religion around him, all these people following him. So his family comes out to meet him, and a lot of his family members, his cousins and brothers, and because they're all kind of a large family, yeah, a few thousand people, they go for it. They decide to become monastics. There was no nuns at that time, but this is also the start point of the nun community as well, because this is when Mahapajapati Gotami, the Buddha's foster mother, she actually asked for the going forth for the first time. That's a different story. I'm not going to go there. So all of these young men from good families, that's how they explained in the suttas, young men from good families, they decide to go forth. Yeah, to become monks, because they're inspired by the Buddha. He's their cousin, and he's obviously done something remarkable. We want to do the same. And then there's two brothers, and these brothers are called Anuruddha and Mahanama. And Anuruddha and Mahanama, from their family, no one has gone forth. Yeah? So Mahanama goes to Anuruddha and says, Anuruddha, listen, all of these young people are going forth, they are becoming monastics. It sounds really cool to be a monastic. It doesn't say cool, but you know, something like that. It sounds really good to become a monastic. Someone should go forth from our family as well. Yeah? And then Anuruddha replies, well, you know, I have been brought up so softly. I've always been pampered to the max. And there's a nice story about Anuruddha with the natty cakes. Natty in Pali is there isn't, yeah? So in his household, there was always cakes. Whenever he would go to his mother, he said, Mother, can I have some cakes, please? And there was always cakes available because it was a wealthy household and all of that. But one day, there isn't any more cakes. So his mother says to him, Natty cakes, meaning there are no cakes. But he's not used to the word natty, there isn't. He doesn't understand the word there isn't. He never heard it before. So he thinks it's the name of the cake. So he thinks, oh, natty cakes, yeah, please, let's have some natty cakes. Actually, it means there aren't any cakes. So that is how he was brought up. Yeah, there was no in his household, always had everything. So he says to his brother, Mahanama, he says, I've been pampered so much, there's no way I can stand the going forward. It's just too hard for me. Yeah, I just need to kind of sleep on thick mattresses and all this kind of stuff. And so you go forth. And then Mahanama says to him, well, okay, but if I go forth, what that means, that you are going to have to take over the household business. Yeah, you're going to have to do all the farming, because they were all farmers in those days. So you're going to have to get up, and you're going to have to kind of do all the plowing of the fields. After the plowing, you're going to have to sow the fields. And after the fields are sown, you're going to have to let the water in. That's how they kind of irrigated the fields in those days. When the field had been irrigated, let the water out. Yeah, drain the fields. When the crop starts to emerge, you have to weed the field. Yeah, lots of weeds and fields. Just like here in Australia, lots of weeds everywhere, and bad plants coming out. You have to weed the field. Then when you have weeded the field, the crops are up, you have to reap it, you have to harvest it, then you have to bind it together into balls or whatever, then you have to kind of thresh it, yeah, get all the grain out. Having threshed it, you have to store it, and after storing it, you have to do, and then next year, you have to do the same. And Anuruddha says, but is there no end to this work? If you have to do the same thing next year, it means the year after, and the year after, and the year after. Is there no end to this work? And Mahanama says, that's exactly right. There is no end to the work. And then Anuruddha says, well, in that case, you stay in household life, I will go forth. Yeah, it's a great story. And it symbolizes the problem of the world. It symbolizes this idea that there is no end to things. There is no end to this driving force within us that always moves us forward. There's always more to be done. There is no end to the work. And while you are in the middle of your work, what happens? You die. And then you get reborn. And you already have work in your mind, because you died with work in your mind. And you continue working in your next life. And then you move on like that forever after. And this is the problem of this whole thing, is the eternal going on and on like that. And this is symbolized by this sweet little story of Anuruddha and Mahanama. So that is the idea of craving, and how craving always leads to the, is actually the source of this idea of suffering, and how that actually works. And then you have the third noble truth. The third noble truth, I'm going to go through the last one just very briefly. Third noble truth is the idea of the end of suffering, how all of this eventually comes to an end. If you eliminate the cause of suffering, obviously the suffering itself is going to end. And of course the good news is that there is such a thing as the elimination of the cause. It can be done. It is not necessarily obvious that it can be done, but actually it can be done. And of course, to get that, you have to have a degree of faith. Yeah, many people will tell you that eliminating craving completely is impossible. Yeah, I have heard people say that. I don't believe it's possible to eliminate craving completely. It can't really be done. So there has to be a kind of a degree, in this case, of confidence in these teachings. But the point is, it can be done. It is possible to eliminate that craving. And the reason why it is hard to see that sometimes is because the craving is so close to our personality, to our egos. It is almost part and parcel of who we are. Because the craving is what actually gives us a right to do things in the world. The craving is what kind of gives a legitimacy, if you like, to the doer, to the fact that we should do. And of course we identify with doing. Yeah, you know what I mean? Yeah, doing makes you feel alive. Being creative, creating stuff, is kind of one of the highest, often, things in our society. We look at artists and think how wonderful that they create all this stuff. But actually, from the Buddhist point of view, in the end, the doing is just, it is very closely related to the idea of craving. And the doing itself is a part of our personality, part of our ego. And this is why it is so hard to let go of the craving in the first place, because we identify with it so much. So right there is a very profound aspect of the Buddhist teachings. But the Buddha says it is possible. Yeah, and this is kind of the amazing thing. And when you do that, you eliminate all suffering in life, and you actually come to a point when you experience the highest suffering that is possible for a human being. The very last one is the path that leads to the end of craving. The Noble Eightfold Path. And the Noble Eightfold Path is a big subject, and I usually teach that on meditation retreats over 9 days. I teach just Noble Eightfold Path, nothing else, about 20 hours on the Noble Eightfold Path, but it can be summarized very simply, the Noble Eightfold Path. This is what leads to the end of suffering. You start off with an idea that there is a problem to existence. Yes, you start off with the idea, basically, of these four noble truths that we've just been talking about, because that talks about the problem of existence. And once you have that idea that there is a problem, then you get on this path that the Buddha taught, and that path is really just a path of purifying yourself. Why do we need to purify ourselves? Because an impure mind is a mind that is driven by ill will, by craving and desire. All of these things are distorting forces in the mind. So we gradually reduce these distorting forces until eventually the mind becomes entirely clear. And through that mind, which is entirely clear, only then is it possible to see things in the right way. And therefore, eliminate suffering. Then you have this insight into these Four Noble Truths. And then, that actually then ultimately leads to the elimination of suffering itself. So, there you are. I forgot to say, by the way, I promised at the beginning I was going to talk about how rebirth is integrated into all the Four Noble Truths. I forgot to say that towards the end. So, the Third Noble Truth, how is it integrated there? Well, because the Third Noble Truth is the elimination of that same craving of the Second Noble Truth, which is about rebirth. And in the Fourth Noble Truth, the very first aspect is right view, which again is rebirth, is a very fundamental aspect of the idea of right view. So they're absolutely integrated with the whole thing here. So there you are. That is a short little teaching for you about the Four Noble Truths. Just to give you some basic idea of what these things are. And hopefully you can take it further from there by contemplating these things. That is the talk for tonight. Okay, so do you have anyone has any questions or comments or disagreements or complaints or anything else they would like to voice? Now is your opportunity here. Over there, there's a question over here.
Thank you very much for the talk. Just curious about the organizing forces of rebirth in Buddhism.
Okay, the organizing forces of rebirth. Okay, well, there is really only one. There's one sufficient cause for rebirth, and that is craving itself. Yeah, the idea that you crave is really the sufficient cause. But to really understand the organizing forces, what it really comes from is actually delusion and misunderstanding of the nature of reality. Because it is because of the misunderstanding of reality that you actually crave in the first place. If you saw things in the right way, you wouldn't crave, because you would understand that craving actually takes you away from happiness. And this is kind of the hard thing to understand, because usually we assume that craving actually moves us towards happiness. That's why you crave in the first place, yeah? You only crave because you think it's going to take you somewhere. But actually, it doesn't do that. It always takes you away from happiness. Real happiness is found in the present moment. That is where meditation comes in. The deeper you go into the present moment, the more happiness, real sense of finding the meaning of life, you actually discover right there in the present moment. And of course, because that is where you find the happiness, craving takes you away from that. It is the enemy of happiness, ultimately. So by seeing things clearly, which is overturning delusion, you stop craving. And by stopping craving, that force which drives you into the future life, because craving is almost like a projection into the future, yeah? It's always about the future. So it drives the mind onwards from one existence to another one. Just like you are driven in this life, you get driven from one life to another one, huh? Is that what you're asking here? Something like that, yeah? Okay. Doesn't the question not have to be all that precise, you know, that's okay. It doesn't matter. Anyone else want to ask any question? Yeah. Eddie, go for it. Eddie, you're a very reliable questioner, that's really here. That's one of the things about you.
This could be a hard question, Ajahn Brahmali. Ajahn Brahmali, the Buddha said that the desire brings suffering, okay? Uh-huh. We all know that, or craving brings suffering, okay? That's one thing, okay? On the other hand, he also said, you know, the path towards enlightenment is the middle way, you know? Okay? If you tune the guitar string too much, it will snap. If you leave it too loose, it will play. So how do you, on the other hand, craving, desire being suffering. And how about if you don't have desire, it's the other way, you're being too hard on yourself too. No?
So you want to have a little bit of craving. you want to have the middle way of craving.
So what I do is I notice this, I use my own discretion to deal with things.
Okay, yeah. Well, this is the history of Buddhism. The history of Buddhism is always to find excuses to do what you want, you know. The whole history is like that. So the craving is not part of the middle way. Yeah, there is a middle way, but craving is not really part of it. And this is kind of the point. The middle way is the middle way, not the right amount of craving. The middle way is the middle way, first and foremost, between torturing yourself and indulging. And indulging is craving. So craving is actually an extreme. Yeah, so there is no such thing as... But in a sense, you are right, though, in a sense that you need some kind of motivating force to get you onto the spiritual path. You have to have motivating force to come here. If you didn't come here, you wouldn't be meditating, you wouldn't be doing anything here. And that motivating force which drives you onto the spiritual path is like the kind of the right kind of craving here, or the right kind of desire. So you have to have some kind of desire here. But I think the more important point is not so much... People often worry about overcoming craving, but I wouldn't really recommend to focus too much on that, because actually it's very difficult to just overcome craving. You can't stop craving just out of the blue like that. So much better to focus on the Noble Eightfold Path. What is it that I have to do so as to move in that direction? So forget about craving a little bit. Instead, ask yourself, how do you practice this path? And then... By forgetting about the craving and just focusing on the practice, craving will gradually disappear on its own. So your job is to be kind. Your job is to have a good heart. Your job is to overcome anger. Your job is to care for the people around you, to have a sense of compassion, understanding, wisdom. That is our job. And as we do that, we can leave craving aside a little bit, and the craving will actually take care of itself and will disappear on its own right.
I see this thing as depending on yourself, okay? On what level you are, if you're at a higher level, no doubt, desire being suffering, yes, attachment, all that thing, no. But then if you're on a lower level, when the person still needs that desire, and then if you really go without the desire, then that's not right, isn't it?
You can't go, you can't go without desire.
You have to look at yourself too. What level you are in.
Just be good, have a good heart, Eddie, and you will be doing well. Yeah, that's all you have to do, huh? Yeah. Okay. Anyone else? Over there, over here. Yeah. Okay, so I'll repeat the question for everyone else. So craving is like one thing, but what about aversion? Does that also cause suffering? And aversion is really the flip side of craving. Yeah, so it's craving to get rid of stuff. That's what aversion is. So it is basically the same thing. There is craving to get things and there's craving to get rid of things. And it's basically rooted in the same problem. Both of them are cravings in a sense. So there is this similar kind of problem. So both are problematic. These things are always nuanced, and they're always you can always nuance these things a little bit. I mean, so in the same way that you can say that you should have a bit of craving for the spiritual life, in the same way you can say you can have a little bit of aversion towards some things, have a bit of aversion towards being immoral. So if you have a bit of aversion against being immoral, that's the kind of the right kind of aversion. Don't have ill will, don't get angry about it, but just have a bit of aversion. Or immorality, I don't want to go there. So, and use that as a kind of a stepping stone to get rid of aversion completely at the end of the day. Okay. So let's have a look at the overseas questions. First of all, we have from Russell from Brazil. We are worried that you seem to have lost weight. We hope that you are well. Okay, it's kind of irrelevant whether you lose weight or not. The weight goes up and down. And there's a nice story from the suttas. There is a I think the Buddha is some kind of ascetic, and these ascetics in ancient India, they would often live very ascetically. An ascetic lives ascetically, that kind of makes sense. Because of that, they would get incredibly thin. And after they got very thin, they would kind of return to the old ways, they get fat again. And they would get thin again. And the Buddha said, well, this is just like the body gaining weight, the body going down, doesn't get you anywhere. So, you know, the external things are kind of irrelevant. That's what the Buddha said. Whether you're fat or thin is not really the question. Maybe it is a bad sign, because considering Ajahn Brahm, I'm not really following his example. Maybe I'm being a bad disciple. Am I being a bad disciple? So maybe we'll see what happens. Maybe this week, and I have to kind of look for the food that kind of puts on a bit extra weight. We'll see what happens. But one of the things about someone like Ajahn Brahm is one of the things about him is that his meditation is just very profound. He's a very good meditator. I don't think he really cares about his body, you know, whether he's fat or thin, whether he dies or not. We don't want him to die, but he doesn't care. Please stay longer, don't die. We want you to stay more years. That's what I tell him. I don't tell him every day, I tell him occasionally. People want you to live, they don't want you to die. Eat at least one carrot, not just all this other stuff. No. Very hard to get Ajahn Brahm to eat. He has his English food, and he eats that, not only the English food, but this is English food from the 60s, So kind of old-fashioned English food, that's what he eats. Can't be changed. So sometimes I think it's okay not to follow your teacher. In this case, I think it's okay not to follow my teacher. So Russell from Berlin, I don't think you have anything to worry about. I think everything is actually okay. Anyway, next question. This is from Diana in the USA. How can I not feel sorry for others who do not understand, who are not willing to learn what the Four Noble Truths mean? You can feel sorry, you can have a bit of compassion, you can for other people if they don't really want to hear these things, but remember, it is very hard to know exactly the trajectory and the path of other people. You just don't know where they're going to go, and sometimes you may be on the path and then you lose the path later on, or you practice well and you move forward on the path. It's very hard to know where people are going to go, and some of these other people who are not don't understand the Four Noble Truths, later on they might. They might change their mind. Maybe they are just kind of being a bit rebellious. They don't want to listen to you right now, because sometimes when we try to convert other people, they say, no, I don't want to be converted. So when you pull back a little bit, they might reflect carefully, think, actually, she has a point, And maybe then they might come around to these Four Noble Truths. So don't judge. We just don't know. So you can have a bit of compassion. Everyone in the world deserves compassion, because we're all in this mess together. And that is, I think, a better way of looking at it. And try not to think that you really understand other people. Leave all possibilities open. And then when you do that, you just don't know. You shrug your shoulders and you allow people to do their own thing. And this is one of the great teachings with stories like Angulimala, the famous Angulimala, the kind of really bad guy in the suttas, the one who killed 100 or 1,000 people, depending on which version of the sutta you read. He killed lots of people, and he became an arahant. He was really evil, really bad person, and somehow he was able to turn it around and became an arahant. And this means one of the lessons from that is to never really judge people too fast and allow people the possibility to change and become something more than they are already. Okay, last question from overseas. This is from Sam in Cape Town, South Africa. Is it better to observe suffering with kind eyes with the intention of understanding it rather than reacting to it and trying to control it with your reactions? It is a little bit of both. It is also important in life to live, to counteract the suffering of the world, to do our part, not to be completely passive and say, suffering arising, suffering passing away, climate change arising, climate change passing away, immigration, refugees drowning, refugees, whatever. And of course, that is becoming too passive. It's important that we take a moral stance, that we kind of support our society, that we do our bit to do the right thing, that we help other people. Otherwise, we're not really practicing fully. But at the same time, we should also understand that we're never going to be able to resolve all the problems in the world through action, through changing things, our own life, there's always going to be a residue of suffering that is always there. So we do both in a sense. We understand it. We understand the limitations of what we can do. And then we also have compassion. We also try to do the very best that we can to support the people around us, especially the people around us. Yeah, our friends, our family members, the people who are dear to us. And then also perhaps if we have extra energy and resources, also larger society at the same time. So it's both really is the right way, I would argue, in this particular case. Okay, so that is all for tonight. So let's just pay homage to the Dharma Sangha.
Arahang Samma Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavatang Abhivademi Svakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namassami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savakasango Sanghang Namah.